Well, welcome everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce Mike Senior, the Senior Project Manager at ProForest, to talk about zero deforestation supply chains, which many of you may be aware is a very important topic. It's receiving a lot of attention from the private sector, from governments, etc. He brings with him a PhD in tropical forest ecology, so ecologist by background. He's worked particularly in Latin America and Malaysia at Borneo. And done a lot of extensive field work on forest and oil palm environments in particular, but also some work on REDD+ and community-based monitoring. Without further ado, I think he's going to talk about all the work that he's been doing and ProForest is doing on this the very ambitious zero deforestation pledging that's going on. Thank you.
Thanks, Connie. Hi, everyone. If I get a bit croaky or quiet, just tell me. I seem to have picked up a cold today just in time for this, so I'm sorry about that in advance. I was going to give a very quick intro to ProForest first, just for those of you that are not familiar with us, and then I'll dive into the main bulk of the conversation. But hopefully if I give you a bit of background, it might make a bit more sense why I'm then going to talk about what I'm going to talk about. We are a non-profit group. We have a consultancy wing and a charitable initiative, and our mission is to support the transformation of natural resource production for greater sustainability, very general. And we do that through kind of three main aspects of work. Firstly, by facilitating policies and standards, so certification standards, for example, the RSBO, developing policies through other multi-stakeholder initiatives. So we are often a technical facilitator in those processes. We are then, through our consultancy work, helping to implement sustainable practices for companies, with companies in their supply chains or at a production level. That's kind of the bulk of where we, I guess, do our work and get our experience about the challenges of implementing on the ground as well. And then finally, we do a lot of capacity development as well. So that's mostly on our charitable initiative side. And that's the sort of longer term work that we're doing to train up assessors, conservation assessors on the ground, auditors, working with governments to build their capacity as well, focused primarily at a production level. The idea being that in the future, and increasingly, it's less of us going and flying to places and doing consultancy, it's actually people from the countries where the production is happening. Given that we work mostly on tropical commodities, that's an important part of our work. As I said, we have these two arms, consultancy and programmatic work. And in terms of our scope and our location globally, we have now five offices. So our Oxford office is our main international office. We also have an office in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, office in Accra in Ghana, a sort of few satellite people, including in Cameroon. We have an office in Brazil, in Brasilia, and then we've recently opened an office in Cali in Colombia as well. So quite a global reach. Most of our work focuses on the three regions where we have those offices in the tropics. And in terms of the commodities that we're working on, it's a lot of the big kind of deforestation associated commodities. So palm oil, soy, wood products, cattle, and sugar, which is obviously broader issues associated with it. And what are we doing around no deforestation? So through our consultancy work, we are supporting companies in developing responsible sourcing commitments and then implementing them. Deforestation is obviously a key part of that. We're also at a production level helping companies to comply with these commitments and develop their own commitments as well as producer companies. That includes by doing high conservation value and high carbon stock assessments. Essentially, if a company wants to develop, we will help them work out which areas they can and can't develop, where's forest that needs to be protected, either because of its biodiversity value, because of its community social use, or because it's deemed as a forest and this company is committed to no deforestation. Typically, that's for the palm sector, but also occasionally in forestry as well. Otherwise, we, through our charitable initiative work, our programmatic work. We work more at a policy level, primarily through a range of multi-stakeholder initiatives. And that's more around developing these broader policies and methodologies to then implement no deforestation in practice. Some of the main ones that we're involved in are the high carbon stock approach. So that's, again, a multi-stakeholder body that recently developed a methodology for implementing no deforestation on the ground, so for identifying where you can and can't develop in a concession. HCV Resource Network is a similar body that is focused specifically on the high conservation value approach and aims to support the implementation and uptake of that through FSC, through the RSPO, and through other mechanisms. We are involved in that as well. And then finally, a new initiative, because we didn't have enough already, is the Accountability Framework, which is a coalition of NGOs, international NGOs, that are trying to come up with common guidance and rules for what responsible sourcing commitments mean. The logic behind it being that often NGOs are kind of telling companies different things about what they should be doing, but if they can have one united voice, it will simplify the process for companies and allow them to focus on getting the work done rather than responding to different demands. So that's a bit of background about what we do in this space. Now I'll get on to what I was going to talk about. It's going to be a sort of mostly focused on quite sort of theoretical global trends that we've been observing and kind of learning from the work that we're involved in. And then I'll finish with a few examples to try and illustrate what I've been talking about. And finally, just a few, maybe controversial suggestions as to how research and the research community can contribute to this work. So I feel like for this audience, I thought that maybe there'd be more undergrads and master's students. So I don't really need to even show this slide, I'm sure, but why forests and deforestation? The concern in the global community is driven primarily by these three parts here: climate change, habitat and biodiversity loss, and then the social impacts, whether it's displacement, loss of community use areas, cultural sites. And of course, in terms of the drivers of that, we know well that agriculture and timber production are major parts of that. Of course, driven by rising consumption and populations globally. So that's sort of the very broad context of where no deforestation came from. What about specifically the no deforestation commitments that were being made in the commodity sector and commodity supply chains? So again, largely driven by consumer and NGO demand, concerned primarily with tropical deforestation. I think that there's sort of been over the last 30 years efforts to try and halt the deforestation that's happening through different approaches, through certification, through government-led initiatives. More recently, there's been quite a lot of funding specifically to do that in order to tackle climate change. There's kind of been the view from a lot of international NGOs, of course, that producer governments are not doing enough to target that. And the idea is that campaign NGOs wanted to harness private sector resources and sort of reputational concerns to try and tackle deforestation. So all of this led to a lot of big campaigns. I suppose most of them were sort of kicking off 10 or 15 years ago, primarily focused on the palm oil sector. The most infamous graphic one was probably the Greenpeace campaign against Nestle about Kit Kat and orangutan fingers. There have been various campaigns since. And essentially what these campaigns have been pushing for is to try and eliminate deforestation from supply chains. Recognising and focusing really on the big commodities associated with deforestation, so wood production, palm, soy and beef. And these campaigns have had differing levels of success across those commodities. A lot of the attention has been on palm. That's quite a high-profile commodity and an export commodity, but I'll talk a bit in a minute about where those campaigns are focused. What kind of commitments are we talking about here? So they've happened at many levels, of course. We've had government level, high level commitments. We've had individual company commitments as well, mostly driven by the consumer end, so NGOs, consumer companies, consumer governments to some extent as well. Perhaps kicking off really with declarations like the New York Declaration on Forests, signed by a series of companies and governments at a production and a consumption end. Consumer Goods Forum was a resolution was obviously focused on consumer goods companies, the likes of Unilever and Mars, Mondelez, these kind of companies. These were some of the sort of first overarching declarations that were made. And typically on the back of that, individual companies have then made their own responsible sourcing commitments as well. So if you go and look on the websites of most of these companies, consumer goods companies, or even producers, traders of big agricultural commodities as well, you'll find they have their own commitments detailing what they're doing about deforestation, about labour rights and so on. The term generally used is NDPE commitments, which is broadly no deforestation, peat and or exploitation. As I sort of alluded to, the focus of these private sector commitments has been a bit skewed. This is quite a nice graphic from the Forest Trends report last year, which shows on the bottom there and the sort of coloured lines, coloured bars should I say, the number of companies surveyed and then the proportion with commitments to no deforestation. The bubbles at the top are the actual deforestation footprint of those commodities. And as you can see, there's been a lot of commitments made in the palm sector and quite a lot in timber forestry sector as well. But in terms of deforestation footprint, those two are actually contributing far less than soy and cattle. It's partly because a lot of the deforestation that has happened over the past 15 years has happened in Latin America, but it's also a function of the commodities as well. So it's interesting to see that, and shows that to some extent the NGO campaigns focused on these sectors have had different levels of success, really. So cattle, beef production, a lot of beef production in Brazil is for domestic consumption, so there hasn't been that leverage for NGOs of targeting the big international brands. Soy, again, is kind of an indirect product. It is in a lot of the food that we're eating, of course, through livestock and dairy, but hasn't really been picked up on until quite recently. Whereas palm, I think, has been seen as a good one, and there's been a lot of success of campaigning in the palm sector. This is another graphic just showing the same thing, really. So taken from a study a couple of years ago as well. You see the breakdown of deforestation and the trends in deforestation by different sectors. So the blue at the top is showing deforestation, land use change associated with timber wood production, relatively small. Palm is in green, slightly quite a lot bigger than wood production, but enormous relative to the other commodities. Soy, more again than palm, and then the lion's share is related to cattle production. So, yeah, interesting trends. So, yeah, what does that mean in practice for these companies with responsible sourcing commitments? So how do they implement them? How does that process work? ProForest as an organisation does support a lot of companies in that process. We have produced guidance to help companies go through that process, and we also directly support them in doing that. It broadly involves a few key steps. It's normally more than this, but just distilled down into three. You can talk about awareness, then commitment, and then implementation. So by the time a commitment is made, generally there's awareness internally within the company about what the problems are, and then a commitment is made. You'd hope it was an informed commitment based on what was realistic and achievable. It's not often been the case. And then you move into implementation, which is where the company tries to implement those commitments across its supply base, which is easier said than done. And that's when you're trying to translate those sourcing commitments into responsible production practices on the ground. And that then, of course, involves a whole series of other steps as well. And there's a whole array of different initiatives that have tried to kind of define processes for for going through these steps and identifying forest to protect, protecting it, and then monitoring it. It is a difficult process for most of these big multinational companies that are sourcing from hundreds of countries, thousands of suppliers, just to even get to the point where you know where you're sourcing from, let alone whether those suppliers are actually implementing your commitments. So if you've got to the point where you've done some supply chain mapping, you can then start to do risk assessment and work out where the high risk suppliers are, and then start a process of engagement. That in itself presents challenges as well, just because often there's variable commercial relationships between the company that's buying products and its suppliers. Unless you've got a very stable relationship and that supplier is a really big supplier, it's quite difficult for your Unilevers of the world to actually exert influence over the behaviour, because there's quite a good chance that they could just switch to another buyer and then they wouldn't have to make any changes and then all things continue. So it's a sensitive process of trying to build trust and build relationships that then allows you to talk to those suppliers about implementation and trying to make changes on the ground. So how far have we got with implementing best practice? This was kind of the main thing I wanted to talk a bit about, just to sort of take stock of where we are now and the success of these supply chain commitments in reducing deforestation in practice. So we have had a lot of successes over the last 10 years. A lot more companies have become aware of the issues and have started to make commitments. As I said, globally, high-level declarations, individual company commitments as well. That's been a huge change from where we were 15 years ago. I mean, if you look at the palm sector, for example, the RSPO, the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, is only, 13 years old, I think. The number of companies with commitments has gone from none about 5 years ago to 80% by some estimates of global palm oil production in now. So that's a huge change. We've also seen the development of new tools and approaches to help actually implement those commitments. So the high carbon stock approach is one. GIS technology has been a revelation over the last few years that allows companies to monitor what's happening in their supply chains and pick up deforestation. And so in terms of results, and I don't have a very good graphic or any kind of reference to back this up, but there has been a slowing of deforestation in concessions of companies with commitments, particularly in the palm sector. And yet, we're not really seeing deforestation slowing in a lot of cases. So we've got some awareness, we've got growing commitment, but the implementation piece is proving difficult. And a lot of these commitments made by private sector actors were to eliminate deforestation from their supply chains by 2020. So there's definitely still some questions and challenges out there. Just quickly on the successes and some of the practicalities of how you implement these commitments on the ground. One of them I mentioned is the HCS approach, high carbon stock approach. Has now been integrated into one process with HCV. I won't go into the details of that, but basically two quite widely used methodologies for identifying important values in forest on the ground are used together to kind of pick up a range of values from carbon to biodiversity to social values. There is a methodology now for doing that, a manual for how you do it as a company or as a consultant working for a company. How does it work in practice? You do the assessment before any development has happened. So let's say you're a palm company, you've been given a plot of land, you get a team in to do these assessments, biodiversity surveys, social surveys, participatory mapping, consultation with relevant stakeholders at a local and a national level, and then you map out your areas to protect. And if this company has made a commitment or wants to get certified as a sustainable producer, they have to comply with these areas, with these findings, and protect those areas. Otherwise, their buyers, in theory, will stop buying from them, or they won't get the certification that they need to sell to a market that's demanding that. At the moment, this approach is only really being used at scale by large producers in the palm sector and a few in the forestry sector as well, timber plantations primarily. And it's mostly being used in Southeast Asia, and it's mostly being used in the parts of Southeast Asia that are already quite deforested and fragmented. It's not really a viable option in high forest cover contexts like Papua New Guinea or Papua, because a company needs to cut down forests if they want to have a business in those locations, which is kind of the point, I guess, that you can't develop in those contexts. But in practice, there are challenges with that. So I'll talk a bit about that in a minute. Just very quickly to kind of give you an idea of what that might look like. This is an example of an oil palm development in Gabon for a company that was wanting to protect high conservation value and high carbon stock areas. The black line is the boundary of the concession. It's can't see it very well, but it's a forest savanna mosaic landscape. And if you kind of, once you've done these assessments, you can kind of overlay these different areas that have to be protected. So in most countries, you will have first up some kind of legal requirements for areas you have to protect, often riparian buffers. So that's typically the first thing you would put in there, sometimes steep slopes as well. Then if the company has followed a proper FPIC process and you've done enough mapping of community land, there should be areas of community use, assuming there are communities present, that are excised from development as well and set aside for community use in the future. You then identify your forest areas, high carbon stock areas that you're setting aside, and finally any HCV areas. And in this case, it's depending on the landscape you're looking at, it wouldn't always look like this. This is, as I said, a forest savanna mosaic. So if you're in a purely forested area, often your HCV would be nested within your HCS areas. But yeah, ultimately you can end up with a lot of areas that have to be set aside. This is a company performing at a very high level, doing things right by the book. And that is protecting a large area of the landscape, which is going to have serious conservation value in the long term. Of course, not everyone is doing it to that extent.
Do you have to know in this context the board what decided the high conservation value? What conventions?
So it's a mixture of different values. HCV1, which is rare threatened species, so there's a couple of species that were right at the northern edge of their range that were found in the concession using some of the savanna areas. HCV3, because there's a part of this savanna is quite unique woody savanna formations. Again, quite unique. That's a bit on this eastern edge, to the east of that river. Obviously, there's the community use of that area there, which could also be considered HCV5. And then this bit here was added really as a corridor to help connect up those areas. So in total, actually, there's another concession here where there's a bit protected as well. That's a 5 kilometre wide corridor from east to west.
And who decides on the community boundaries?
So the community boundaries are determined based on participatory mapping with the communities. So ProForest did this assessment. So we work with a local social NGO that goes into the villages and does participatory mapping with the communities. So that's doing walks around with the hunters, the fishermen, mapping all of the sites that they're using and the boundaries of the areas they're using, mapping all the cultural sites. So it's all done by walking in the field with the GPS, producing these maps, going back in the village and validating those maps with the villagers. And in terms of how the other areas are defined, the high conservation value areas, that's done again through a consultative process. So we work with the local experts that have done the surveys. We then sit down and work out which are the important areas which qualify as HCV in this Gabonese context. We then present these draft results and maps to stakeholders at a national level, so WWF, other environmental NGOs, and basically validate those maps. And quite often there's a lot of back and forth to kind of work out what's considered significant. It's, as a concept, HCV is not very tightly defined for a reason. But in the end, by going through this consultative process and talking to the right people, you can come up with agreed approaches and outcomes. And yeah, generally well supported if you follow those processes properly.
How long does the process usually take?
Depends on the size of the area slightly, but normally around 6 months, sometimes even longer. I mean, again, there's a real range. This is sort of, I mean, we like to think that we do things at a good level and follow the process properly. Some other consultants historically would have done these assessments in about a month, but then they wouldn't be very good most of the time. So, yeah, it really depends on the context and the seasonality as well. In some cases, you need to sample over multiple seasons as well, so that can often extend the process.
So is the rest of the bits that you haven't highlighted yourself, that's forest?
No, that's all degraded savanna, basically, that can be developed for palm in this context. So those are areas that have been identified as not being used by any communities, not having particular ecological value, not being forested. So they're sort of considered up for development. So that was kind of what's there now and what can be used. Within a context of certification, this is a very effective mechanism, and the company here is required now to maintain all of those areas as conservation areas to remain certified under the RSPO. So they will be audited to make sure that they are protecting those areas. So that is a mechanism that, in theory, keeps those areas protected over time. The challenge is, in a lot of cases, you don't really have the same safeguards to ensure that these policies are being implemented and the forest being protected on the ground. So, as I said, deforestation is continuing. So we've been thinking a lot about why that is and why the private sector commitments are not having more of an impact. And very broadly speaking, we've kind of honed in on a couple of things that we think are missing from what's being done to implement these practices. So the first thing is a need to focus more on this protection piece. So as I said in the previous slide, you've kind of got a mechanism there through certification, but there's not really been much focus on that so far. A lot of focus on identifying and monitoring. And the second thing is about better understanding the sort of typology and context in which deforestation is happening. So I'll try and explain a bit more about what I mean by that. So as I said, defining, identifying, monitoring, a lot of stuff has happened in that space. A lot of initiatives have popped up that allow companies to define and identify forests that they shouldn't be cutting down. As I said, the HCS approach, the high conservation value approach, do that to some extent. There's other initiatives defining what deforestation is, different definitions of zero gross, zero net deforestation. That's all out there. There's sort of relatively good agreement on a lot of that. Similarly, for monitoring, amazing tools now. Global Forest Watch, Starling, really kind of high-end GIS tools that allows you as a company to monitor your supply base if you know where you're sourcing from. But there isn't really much in this kind of protection piece. So how do you actually make sure that there's an incentive for your suppliers or on the ground, the forests that have been identified and that you can monitor are actually being protected? You can see, once you've done an assessment, that these areas should be protected. And then you can see later on maybe that they've been chopped down, but that doesn't tell you why they were chopped down or who chopped them down. And those are the kind of questions that you need to really answer if you're going to try and protect forests in the long term. So some of the things that are being used and talked about now as trying to plug this gap are having business-to-business commitments. So that might be, you know, a consumer goods company that has a strong supplier relationship with one supplier. They could support them directly through funding to put in place practices and have conservation set-asides. They can do that because they've got that strong relationship and they can trust that, you know, what's being done on the ground will be effective and will work. Doesn't work necessarily if you've got a really disparate supply base. I mentioned certification. That's one mechanism that sort of verifies implementation. And the other big piece is increasing landscape and jurisdictional approaches, which I'll talk about a bit more in a minute. Just to say, I think part of the reason why this protection piece has been missing, why the other things have come so far, is because of the nature of what they involve. So forest definition, forest identification, monitoring, they're mostly technical challenges, not exclusively, but there are things you can get quite a long way towards with GIS and with remote sensing technologies. You can do that remotely and you can scale it across large areas. So that's something that's been very effectively done over the past few years. But actually protecting those areas over time is very different. It's largely a social economic problem. It's also very context specific. So whilst you can, to some extent, generalise your forest definitions across biomes, you can't necessarily generalise your protection interventions across such large scales as well. And also, you've got to be able to build long-term local solutions for protection as well. You've got to engage with the people on the ground that are working there, whether it's government, whether it's civil society, whether it's the smallholders that are causing deforestation, and you've got to build these long-term solutions to have equitable development and protection as required. So that's kind of a huge challenge that hasn't really been progressing as fast as people would like, for obvious reasons. The second point that I mentioned was this idea of looking at the typology of deforestation, which then helps you to tailor your protection solutions to the ground. So what this comes down to is really asking companies in a supply chain what leverage they have over the suppliers in their supply base and what they can do themselves versus what they need to work more collaboratively with others to tackle. That's not working. As I said, you need to tailor your solutions. You can kind of, this is speaking very globally, very broadly, but you can break down typologies into different contexts broadly based on the type of actors, what their motivations are, the land rights they have, and then sort of categorize different commodities into those classes. So as a first broad category, you have concessions. So these are typically companies, in some cases communities as well, mostly motivated by commercial reasons. The land rights are over very large areas and they're normally fixed term leases, so there's no kind of ownership, it is a lease. And these are the kind of context you have for a lot of palm, to some extent rubber production and also fibre production. It's very common in Southeast Asia and Africa, less common in Latin America. You then have direct ownership. That's where these are properties in most cases. So it might be individual, they might be family, they might be community owned. In some cases, it might be a company. Motivations here vary, and again, you have a different range of sizes that fall into this category. Privately owned, and this is far more common in the soy, beef, and fiber sectors. Another big category that you have to deal with is small holdings. This is, again, typically individuals or families. Sometimes it might be a company scheme. But more often than not, it's livelihood driven. And this is where you kind of have a distinction between the first two categories. It's not commercial. It's, you know, it's small-scale agriculture to feed the family and so on. In terms of the land rights there, smaller areas, different kinds of land tenure situations. And that's something you do have across most commodities. Palm is about 50% of all production. Rubber, I think, is about 80%. And finally, you have a category which sort of, I guess, is quite cross-cutting, and that's illegal encroachment, illegal activities, which often companies and smallholders could all be responsible for this in their own, in different contexts. But it's a very different context. Which is driven by, in some cases, speculation, which is not necessarily out of livelihood needs. That could be greed, it could be corruption. In other cases, it is poverty driven. You know, cocoa expansion into protected areas in Côte d'Ivoire is often migrants coming into the area from elsewhere in the country or coming over the border from Liberia, desperate to try and get a plot of land to make a living from. But they have no rights to that land. It's usually small areas. again, presenting a whole load of challenges for how you as a supply chain company can try and tackle that on the ground. Linked to that is another problem which is particularly unique to deforestation as a kind of supply chain issue, and that's the fact that, and this might sound pretty obvious, but deforestation happens before you're a producer. So if you're a company that's buying a product, you don't know this person, that they don't exist to you until they're selling you something. But for a commodity like palm oil, that means they cut down the forest about 5 years ago. So you, if you are buying from them, you have almost no way of influencing their behavior unless you can somehow engage with them before the deforestation happens. So there's got to be ways of doing it so that we are a bit more proactive as a community in trying to address that. So how can you get to people on the ground before they go along some road, along some axis that's been opened up by a company and then start developing that? How can you discourage any development happening in those contexts? Because as a company, you do have leverage over existing suppliers if they're already there, and maybe they're looking to expand in the future. But for all of those who are not yet producers, you have no leverage. You also have differences depending on the type of operation as well. So I've talked about it a bit already, but if you have kind of large concessions or large properties, you as a buyer do have relatively good leverage over those suppliers. Small holdings, you can have leverage if the smallholders are grouped in a cooperative, and often there's ways of engaging as a supplier with those, with those suppliers. Less so if they're in completely independent smallholders. And legal encroachment. Again, there's almost nothing you can do to hold leverage over them as a company, because anything you do to try and improve their practices is going to mean more accountability for them. It's going to mean probably having to register their land. It's going to mean having to pay tax. So all of the things that they don't necessarily want to do. So that's one thing that stratifies across these categories. And then the other thing is this issue that I explained about kind of not yet producers. So those are sort of some of the challenges that are there. And then finally, which I guess I've touched on already, is just thinking about more of the ethical question of it as well. We've sort of, as a conservation community, been focusing on deforestation as an environmental problem for a long time, but actually it's not an environmental problem, it's a social problem in a lot of cases too. And as a producer, whether you're an individual or a family that's doing it for livelihood needs, or a slightly bigger producer, it's quite legitimate to ask the question of, you know, what am I getting out of protecting that forest, and what is needed to, as an incentive or as compensation, to kind of make the case for keeping forests standing. There's also an issue in some landscapes that you might lose out if you're, let's say, an Indonesian palm landscape where you have 1,000 smallholders across this landscape. You have some that have land that's under existing plantation, they may have developed it 5 years ago. You have others that have plots of land they've mostly been sitting on, haven't really been using very actively. How do you deal with a situation in that case where you have this huge array of contexts? If the one with forest, if a family or farmer with forest is told to keep that forest standing and they're not being compensated for it, they're going to see their mate down the road in 5 years with lots of money from the palm oil that they've developed, bigger car, probably a bigger house, all of these things. So there's a genuine question of how you can stop this kind of inequity happening and how you can compensate for that. And at the moment, the kind of mechanisms that are being talked about to compensate for that, whether it's RED or payment for ecosystem services, are not really reaching the farmers on the ground. So it is a huge challenge for the commodity sectors. Finally, another bit of doom and gloom. I'm just going to talk a bit about the unintended consequences of what can happen and has happened to some extent over the past 10 years. if we don't get all of these pieces sort of lined up properly and we don't consider the different consequences of what we're doing. So first one is this issue of actually excising forest from lease areas. So I showed you that map a few slides ago of where sort of 60% of the concession was being identified for conservation. For a lot of companies, if you see something like that, if they see something like that, they will just run a mile, and they will see it as not a viable project. Maybe they had in their mind, in their budget projections, that they would develop 80% and get X profit over however many years. There has been a huge problem with companies, particularly farm companies in Southeast Asia, excising parts of these conservation areas from the concession and just giving them back to the government. It means they don't have to pay tax on the land or rent on the land. And in reality, it means that that bit of land is probably going to be given away to another company and cleared. So certification is one way of trying to stop that happening, but often companies find ways of getting around the certification requirements for that. Another issue is leakage at a large scale, which is effectively what was seen with as a result of some of the policy interventions and the soy moratorium in the Amazon, shifting a lot of the production to the Cerrado. And now, of course, that's a huge frontier of deforestation. So it's about having joined up thinking that doesn't result in these kind of knock-on effects of the kind of policy interventions that we're trying to put in place. A major concern that's being talked about a lot in the palm sector now is this idea of splitting the market. So to what extent can initiatives like the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil and can the kind of concerned consumers stay relevant in frontiers of palm development in high forest cover contexts? Because the reality is development is happening in these contexts, whether it's Papua or Papua New Guinea, of Congo Basin. A lot of concessions have been given out by governments. Production is already happening in those contexts. In most cases, it's companies that don't have a no deforestation commitment. If the standards that are set by approaches like the high carbon stock approach are too high, there's a genuine risk that you end up splitting the market into a kind of deforestation-free market, which is palm produced in Peninsula Malaysia and parts of Indonesia where the deforestation happened 20 years ago, that will sell to Europe and North America, whereas the rest from these risky landscapes will just be sold to the biggest markets in India and China. So how can we avoid that happening? How can we ensure that the sort of best possible outcome is achieved in those high-risk areas? Does it mean that we have to somehow lower the bar for those situations to allow limited deforestation, if it means you can save the rest, so you can have viable businesses and keep the good companies in those contexts? There's lots of really challenging questions around that. Finally, I think I talked about that point on the last slide. The fact that deforestation does still pay at a local level, whether you're an individual farmer or a family, the benefits of making those no deforestation commitments are accrued by the consumer goods companies that can put it on their websites and sing and dance about it, and their profits keep rising. But as a farmer on the ground, you know, if you want to make money from your land, you've got to plant something on it to sell in most cases. That was just an example of the number of concessions, forestry and agriculture concessions, already allocated across the Congo Basin. A lot of them being operated on, being used or degraded by companies that are probably exporting to China or markets where there isn't that push for sustainability. So I think it's really important that the international community and the conservation community is trying to find ways of engaging and providing solutions in those contexts. How am I doing for time?
Let's see. You're almost done, right? I think wrapping up in about 5 minutes, it would be good. Yeah.
You can try.
Okay.
I won't ramble as much. There's a lot of text on that slide, so I'm not going to read through it all, but just to say that once you have an understanding of these typologies of deforestation, why it's occurring, where it's occurring, what the motivations are, you can start to think about what the best interventions are. And in most cases, as a supply chain actor, it's not just about what you can do as a company, it's about lots of different approaches working together. And you can kind of break them down into what works in these different contexts, very broadly speaking. So existing suppliers with concessions, in that case you do have that commercial relationship you can build on. You can maybe in some cases look at incentives and compensation if it's a highly forested area that a consumer buyer company could be providing. Similar in cases of direct ownership, although often the supply relationships are a bit more indirect. For existing smallholder suppliers, again, you can use that relationship in some contexts, but you also need to be looking more and more at alternative livelihoods. If you don't want smallholders to be clearing any more forests, then you've got to provide an alternative that allows them to meet their livelihood needs. Illegal encroachment is much more about law enforcement, getting the right legal mechanisms in place in the first place, the right policies in place, and then enforcing them. So that means working with governments. So you as a consumer goods company are going to be able to do almost nothing about that. And then in these cases where the clearance hasn't happened and they're not yet producers, as I said, it's about being preemptive. And so that's where you really do need to be working much more collaboratively with governments, with multi-stakeholder initiatives often that involve producer companies, CSOs and government, basically getting everyone together to try and do things and plan things properly before any development happens. So whether that's landscape level planning, land use planning, these kind of things. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just curious why there isn't any law enforcement for concessions or ownership or smallholdings.
I mean, a lot of these do apply across all of them, but it's kind of from a supply chain perspective, it's thinking about where they really can have an influence. And obviously, if your supplier is not complying with the law, then you probably don't want to be buying from them either.
Probably easier than the illegal encroachment, though.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just kind of about prioritising somehow between the type of interventions. I was going to talk very briefly about a couple of examples because I've been talking quite generally, and then I'll wrap up. One example that everyone always talks about, I guess, as a relative success story is what's happened in Brazil over the past 15 years. So there has been a reduction, although slightly reversing recently, of deforestation declining significantly, and there are a lot of theories about why that has happened, but I think in reality what we've seen through our work is that it's a combination of approaches, things that came together, a lot of it actually based around the work of government, so the forest code and legal incentives to reduce deforestation, particularly in the Amazon. So that included things like credit for municipalities or properties being withheld depending on performance. It included initiatives such as in Acre, where there was a real investment in downstream processing for things like rubber to create employment and livelihood that wasn't entirely reliant on more forest clearance, and compensation as well, for example, for families, communities living in conservation areas and elsewhere. The legal mechanisms here played a big role. There was previously, at least, a lot of government resources being put into enforcement through monitoring and use of technology. And at the same time, you had concerted private sector action as well to eliminate deforestation from regions. So the soy moratorium is a good example of where you had generally good agreement across the private sector to stop sourcing soy from the Amazon. The kind of thing which if one company had done on its own, it probably wouldn't have had an impact, but there was that concerted effort coupled with all the legal changes. Of course, risks and barriers now relate to the fact that there's political change in the country, and of course I talked already about the leakage that happened. I'm not going to talk about that. But this is just one of these not very scientific graphs that people like show, where you put an event on a curve and try and pretend there's a correlation. But I'm going to do it anyway. Just to say that, you know, these are a range of different interventions and initiatives that happened in Brazil that were designed to try and tackle deforestation somehow. But just to kind of illustrate that it wasn't necessarily the soy moratorium, which a lot of people say was the most effective measure, that actually only came into place after deforestation started falling. Whereas this... I'm going to forget the acronym now. Pedro can probably... Yeah, so this is a government plan to reduce deforestation in the Amazon region, basically. Did happen at the peak. But also, interestingly, you can look at the economic factors as well. So the green line is the exchange between the reais and the US dollar, and you can see that there's probably a big economic driver in that deforestation as well. In terms of the technology, I mean, yeah, there's a whole array of different approaches that are used in Brazil to monitor deforestation. You have the CAR, which is the Forest Code Registration, and there's a system called SICA, which is now live, which is basically a way of government monitoring self-declaration of compliance with the Forest Code. And it's something that supply chain companies can then use to see whether their suppliers are complying with legal requirements, and those legal requirements get you a certain way towards the commitments that the companies are making. So a good mechanism that is kind of covering all of those pieces I was talking about before, that firstly you identify your forest that you want to protect, and then you can monitor it through this, and then there's consequences if you don't comply, which then intensifies you to protect those areas over time.
Okay.
We going to stop?
Yeah, we're already past 5 minutes. Are you going to wrap up?
Okay. I will...
I'm sure there will be a lot of good discussion too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, I was just going to say very quickly, in terms of comparing Brazil to Indonesia, you've almost got the opposite context, where there's a lack of legal enforcement, corruption, conflicting political agendas. So the private sector is kind of acting in a bit of a vacuum there on what they're trying to do. And that's sort of changing now, to some extent. But you're also seeing companies forming collaborations and trying to work in landscapes in a way that perhaps the government should be taking more of a leading role, but companies are kind of skipping around that and trying to do that. So initiatives like the fire-free villages and so on. I'll leave it there, and I won't mention this because it's probably not necessary, but I'll just leave it on the screen and then open up to questions.
All right, thank you very much.